the reading of the Sioux City Journal. Today is Sunday, November 5th. I'm Dagna, your reader today. We'll begin with today's mini editorial, which was written by Taffy Lorenzer of Sioux City. And Taffy writes, "The World Series played the national anthem prior to the game. People in the crowd stood, if they could, took their hats off, and some placed their hand over their heart. Being a veteran's wife, it made me proud to be an American and call the United States home." Again, this was written by Taffy Lorenzer of Sioux City. We have a couple of election-related stories with Election Day coming up this coming Tuesday. The first one is about the school board. Greenwell top spender in school board race. Trayla Lee has outraised and Dan Greenwell has outspent each of the 11 candidates running for the Sioux City School Board. Lee's campaign raised $5,085.02, with contributions ranging from $25 to $1,000 as of Thursday. Greenwell has self-funded $11,000 to his campaign and had the most total expenditures of $11,429.49. All school board members are required to submit an accounting of their campaign finances, including donations, loans, and expenditures, 5 days before the election. Campaigns that raise less than $1,000 do not have to submit disclosure forms. Here is a breakdown of each candidate's financing as reported in their disclosure forms as of Thursday. Greenwell started with $429.49, which carried over from his campaigning in 2019 for the school board. He self-financed the remaining $11,000 of his funding. A majority of Greenwell's $11,236.55 in expenses went to printed and mail brochures. The remaining financed advertising at Morningside football games and yard signs. His campaign reported $192.94 cash on hand at the end of the period. Lee reported receiving $5,085.02 in contributions as well as a $1,000 self-loan. The donations ranged from $20 to $1,000. Greenwell's wife, Gina, donated $500 to Lee's campaign, and school board member Bob Mickelson donated $40. Lee received $63 in in-kind donations. A majority of Lee's $4,925.96 expenses went towards printing and mailed flyers. The rest of her funding went to yard signs, thank you notes, bank fees, and radio advertising. Her campaign reported $1,159.06 in cash on hand at the end of the period. Marguerite Cortez reported receiving $1,934.60 in contributions, ranging from $20 to $250, including an endorsement and $150 donation from the Western Iowa Labor Federation, and school board member Monique Scarlett donated $25. She also received $246.19 in in-kind contributions. Cortez's $1,204.31 in expenses mainly went towards yard signs, with the remaining going towards donation envelopes, car magnet signs, campaign t-shirts, and credit card fees. Her campaign reported $730.29 cash on hand at the end of the period. Semahar Gebrekadin reported receiving $1,785 in donations, including a $5 self-donation. She received an endorsement and $150 donation from the Western Iowa Labor Federation, as well as a variety of private citizen donations ranging from $10 to $300. Scarlett donated $25. Gebrekadin's $1,514.33 in expenses went toward campaign signs, advertising, thank you postcards, postage, campaign merchandise, and a P.O. box. Her campaign reported $270.67 cash in hand at the end of the period. Lance Emke reported receiving $1,389.60 in contributions, including $539.60 in self-funding. He also self-loaned $2,000 to his campaign. He received an endorsement and $150 donation from the Western Iowa Labor Federation, as well as a variety of private citizen donations ranging from $50 to $250. A majority of Emke's $1,948.48 expenses went toward yard signs. The rest paid for design work for a campaign's logo and sign, postage for letters, and fees for a campaign account. His campaign reported $1,441.12 cash on hand at the end of the period. Earl Miller reported receiving $1,024.95 in donations, including a $9.23 self-donation. The donations from citizens ranged from $10 to $200. Miller also received $2,229.80 in loans, well, $2,112.10 self-loaned, while the remaining $117.70 was loaned by a private citizen. He also received a $20 in-kind donation. A majority of Miller's $2,229.80 expenses went towards yard signs, while the rest went for radio ads and banners. His campaign reported $1,024.95 cash in hand at the end of the period. Tricia Rivers reported receiving $990 in donations, including a $40 self-donation. The donations from citizens ranged from $25 to $100. Scarlett donated $25. Rivers also received a $43.35 in-kind donation. Rivers' $1,369.14 in expenses financed postcards, software, door hangers and stickers, thank you notes, and yard signs. Her campaign reported a negative balance of $379.14 at the end of the period. John Myers reported receiving $850 in donations, ranging from $100 to $250. He reported $39.28 in expenses for thank you cards and equipment to repair previous campaign yard signs. His campaign reported $810.72 cash in hand at the end of the period. Phil Hammond, Jebediah Hibbs, and Dustin Rhodes have not submitted disclosure reports. And now we move to the same sort of reporting for the city council race with the headline, Murphy continues to lead Shaner in fundraising for city council race. Challenger Tom Murphy continues to outraise and outspend incumbent Julie Shaner in the Sioux City Council race, according to documents filed with the state. Under Iowa law, candidates for public office are required to file reports if they raise or spend at least $1,000 during the reporting period. The most recent filing deadline was Thursday. As of Monday, Murphy, who is vying for one open seat on the five-member council, raised $7,100 from contributors ahead of Shaner's $4,400, which her campaign filed on Thursday. Reports filed the first week of October also showed Murphy leading fundraising efforts. At that time, Murphy raised $4,890 to Shaner's $1,050. Tricia Frederick, another challenger who was ousted in the October 10th primary, raised $850. Murphy, a lifelong Sioux Cityan, who served as the city's chief building inspector before retiring, is being backed by the Western Iowa Labor Federation, a coalition of 500 state and local AFL-CIO labor councils. He was also endorsed by the Siouxland Chamber of Commerce Good Government Committee. The latest report reveals that Murphy spent more than Shaner, a businesswoman who previously owned and operated Soho American Kitchen and Bar. Murphy had $5,785.24 in expenditures to Shaner's $2,986.54. The largest of the 26 campaign contributions Murphy received was $1,000. Casey and Vanessa Jones gave him $1,000, as did Casey and Molly Fenton. According to the report, Murphy's $500 contributions came from Heidi Day, who also made a $250 contribution, Paul Anderson, and Joe and Patty Rarrett. Ben Murphy gave $350, while Stephen Nelson contributed $300. Other $250 contributors were Jim and Deb Shooter, Todd and Tara Szymanski, and Cherise Yanni. Although the bulk of Murphy's contributions came from individuals and family, he did receive $250 from the Western Iowa Labor Federation's COPE Fund. Rhonda Capron, a former councilwoman whom Shaner edged by 361 votes in 2019, donated $100 to Murphy's campaign. Shaner received 8 donations, the largest of which was $3,100 from James T. Bernstein. David Bernstein gave her $300, as did James Jung. Ernest Colt contributed $250 to Shaner's campaign, according to the most recent report. Sioux City Council seats are elected at large and are officially nonpartisan. Our next story is about the Siouxland Initiative, and the headline is, the Siouxland Initiative will challenge public sector when warranted. At its annual luncheon on Friday, the Siouxland Initiative took time to celebrate the many partnerships it has formed with the public and private sectors in the tri-state region. But TSI President Chris McGowan stressed the organization has not hesitated to call out public bodies that are supporting projects or initiatives it feels are not in the best interest of the community. In prepared remarks, McGowan cited the City of Sioux City's proposed $480 million renovation of the Regional Wastewater Treatment Project, noting the initiative has worked very aggressively and sometimes been criticized for driving or attempting to drive, and quite honestly force, a dialogue between our public and private sectors. Despite McGowan's repeated pleas to slow down the project, the City Council majority in May, over the objections of large industrial users, approved substantial sewer rate hikes to help finance the project. McGowan also mentioned the tremendous chaos related to the construction of the Woodbury County Law Enforcement Center. The new jail has been beset by a series of mishaps and construction delays as the project costs have skyrocketed from the $50 million voters approved in March 2020 to over $70 million. I want to assure you that we will not shrink from engaging on those projects and doing all that we can to make sure that every dollar invested by our public sector on behalf of your hard-earned dollars is invested wisely and in the long-term interest of our community, representing the best value proposition, McGowan told over 150 TSI members gathered at the Stony Creek Inn. I know that we don't all agree, and that's okay. Despite its disagreements over the wastewater issue, the Siouxland Initiative, the Economic Development Division of the Siouxland Chamber of Commerce, recently helped the city acquire a 20-acre site for future industrial development for $760,000. The land abuts the city's existing Southbridge Business Park. It was easier for the initiative to go ahead and buy it, with an understanding that the city would then buy it from them, City Economic Development Director Marty Dowdery said. The transfer of the land from the TSI to the city closed Friday morning, McGowan told the audience. The transaction is another example of our cooperation between the Siouxland Initiative and our municipal partners, McGowan told the Journal after the meeting. And while cooperation is our primary objective, there are times where we have to hold one another accountable, and there has been some disquiet between our respective organizations as we try and make sure that we get this $470 million wastewater treatment plant investment correct. The City of Sioux City also recently acquired 122 additional acres for around $3 million to further expand Southbridge, Dowdery said. The city has been talking with multiple prospective businesses, all of which would bring significant capital investment and high-paying jobs to the city. The economic development director said he could not specifically identify the prospects. The keynote speaker for the TSI's annual luncheon was Tony Audino, a 1976 Bishop Heelan High School graduate with over 35 years of executive and entrepreneurial experience. Audina, who heads PeoplePath, a human capital softball firm with 150 clients, spoke on the emergence of artificial intelligence in business and industry. Audino said the recent introduction of ChatGPT, an AI tool capable of taking written inputs from users and producing human-like responses, was kind of an inflection point for the industry. I think that, in some cases, we're going to see more and more and more of on AI. That's why I'm trying to talk to people and say, you need to really begin to understand how it's going to impact your business, because otherwise you are going to wake up one day and you could be in trouble. It is moving fast. Aldino, a co-captain of Heland State Championship football team in 1975, said the benefits of AI outweigh the risks associated with the technology. Spend some time and really start to understand it and learn it, he said. It will not solve all your concerns, but there are some really good people trying to make sure we control this, and business people and political leaders and so forth. So you know I'm an eternal optimist, and I do believe that, like any technology, you have to be concerned about the risks, but the opportunities far outweigh the risks associated with it. Sioux City hosts premiere of wrestling docuseries. The series, The Duel, is about a 1986 wrestling match. February 23, 1986 is a date etched in Iowa wrestling history. That was the date of a wrestling duel between the 8-time defending NCAA national champion Iowa Hawkeyes and the upset-minded Iowa State Cyclones. The fifth installment of a 6-part documentary series made about the event called The Duel premiered in Sioux City Saturday night at the RE/MAX City Center. On hand for the premiere were University of Iowa's then head coach Dan Gable and Iowa State University's then rookie head coach Jim Gibbons. Gibbons was an executive producer on the project. The director of the docuseries, John Myers, a native of Eagle Grove, was also in Sioux City for the premiere. The screening was followed by a question and answer period. Gibbons said, this was about that duel. It's about the guys that wrestled in it. It's told by the guys that wrestled in it, the guys that coached it, that reported on it later. More so than anything, it is a time capsule about what wrestling was like back in that era, and it morphs into a story about Gable and the University of Iowa program winning the 9 in a row. The docuseries features extensive video coverage of the competition from the Iowa Public Television archives, as well as contemporary interviews with the head coaches, assistant coaches, athletes, television commentators, and others. Gable said watching the archival footage from the duo was moving. It really makes me think about my life. I'm upset with myself a little bit about that, the inconsistencies. There are things in this that make me go back and say, I can't believe I was that way. It is a story of my life from the standpoint of, I like perfection, I certainly wasn't always perfect, Gable said. Meyer said this was an important story to tell. He said, Coach Gable said this earlier, everything is wrestling. Wrestling is life. I am a storyteller and I was also a wrestler. Not a very good wrestler, not to the level of what these guys did, but I am part of the fraternity. It is a story worth telling. We did it to help people and to show what the sport and what relationships and trust can do. It is a story worth telling. These guys are worth knowing. All the athletes, they've all gone on to do tremendous things. It's pretty humbling, I've got to tell you. As a storyteller, you look at it, is it compelling? I am biased, but it is a compelling story, and it's worth sharing. Gable said wrestling teaches many lessons about life. He said, you learn how to get up. You learn how to work hard. You learn to go to bed, get some sleep, and recover. You learn everything. You learn how to come back because you did get a good night's sleep. You learn that you have to be disciplined enough to learn how to do takedowns and counters and escapes and reversals and pinning. If you want to be good and you want to be part of something good, you have to have a lot of discipline. Meyer said the entire 6 episodes will be available for streaming on many platforms, including Prime Video, Google Play, Apple TV, later this month. Coach Gibbons and I worked through the edits of all 6 episodes for the last 3 years. This is the world premiere of episode 5 and is the culmination of our story, of our arc, Meyer said. There are about 11 storylines that get developed after the last hand is raised. It's pretty interesting. When you think it's over, we take a pretty hard left turn. And it's about the guys and the characters. We are expecting people to be moved. I'm going to start that paragraph over again because a video started playing. I don't know why, but anyway. And so we're about the premiere of the docuseries. And it's a story worth telling. We did it to help people and to show what the sport and what relationships and trust can do. It is a story worth telling. These guys are worth knowing. All the athletes, they've all gone on to do tremendous things. It's pretty humbling, I've got to tell you. As a storyteller, you look at it, is it compelling? I am biased that it is a compelling story and it's worth sharing, I think. There are 11 storylines that get developed after the last hand is raised. It's pretty interesting. When you think it's over, we take a pretty hard left turn, and it's about the guys and the characters in this. We are expecting people to be moved. You have athletes talking about these two gentlemen who were their mentors. Myself, as a little kid growing up in Eagle Grove, I looked up to all of these guys. The coaches sat next to each other for hours filming their memories of that day and that duel. We could not have done this project without Coach Gable showing up, Gibbons said. It was a pretty cool thing to be part of. Coach Gable has few rivals. For a short period of time, I got to be a rival, and that's distinguishing enough in my career to gain that status. The trio all thanked Chris McGowan, president of the Siouxland Chamber of Commerce, for helping bring the premiere to Sioux City. We are here in Sioux City because of Chris McGowan. He gave us a lot of help with the project here, and we are thanking him, Gibbons said. And now a letter from the editor, or Bruce Miller, and the headline is, "We're in the new office, and it's great. I have 7 new keys on my key ring. I don't know how to turn the heat up in my office, and I'm sure I can't tell anyone how to find the new restrooms, but we are in. After months of working from home, the Sioux City Journal staff is in its new site at 2802 Castles Gate Road. The office is still full of boxes, stray computers, and pictures that haven't been hung, but we are here. And that's comforting. During the past months, we've done a lot of meetings via Zoom. We've missed phone calls, mail, and visits, but most of all, we have missed being together. When you're near fellow workers, you can ask all sorts of questions and avoid a lot of connectivity issues. Even though it's louder than it was before, it's great to hear the hustle and bustle of reporting. There are changes, too, that come with a new location. Because we share the building and the parking lot with another business, we will not be able to have regular office hours for customers. We will, however, be able to handle you on an individual basis. If you need to talk to someone, please make an appointment and we'll be eager to greet you. All calls should go through Robin. She can be reached at 712-293-4216. If you have problems with subscription or mail delivery issues, we urge you to contact the call center at 712-293-4200. If you're not sure who you should talk to, call Robin. She can transfer calls quicker than anyone else could answer them. If you look online, you will find all sorts of forms for celebrations, obituary, subscriptions, you name it, and that should prove to be an easy fix for many concerns. For the first time in 50 years, we have windows. Yes, windows we didn't have at our old spot at 515 Pavonia Street. New desks and the latest in electronics. Don't believe me? You must see the screen that tells me how many people are looking at our stories online. It is a change, but a welcome one. We realize it may represent a shift for you too, but we hope you will embrace it with the same attitude. What hasn't changed? Our commitment to covering the news in Siouxland. We may be in a new location, but we still blanket the region. And if you want proof of our commitment, I have what they call a spoiler alert. The Sioux City Journal just won the first place award for general excellence from the National Newspaper Association. In an upcoming story, we will detail the 19 other awards we won. And once we're settled, we'll give you a good look at the office. For now, just know we're getting the lay of our new land and we're working just as hard as ever." And this was written by Bruce Miller. We'll now move to the letters to the editor. And our first one is from Paul Gorski from Greenville, South Carolina. "Hi, some of you may remember me. I was on the Sioux City School Board from 2013 to 2017 and lived in Sioux City for over 30 years before moving south to get away from the snow. I still have family in Sioux City and visit every summer. My concern is Tuesday's school board election. I'm impressed with the candidates based on the information published in the journal. I agree with John Meyer's comment on why he's running to possibly bring some previous experience to the board. Along those lines, there are two candidates running that are on the current board, Dan Greenwell, who has 4 years of service plus previous experience as a concerned citizen, and Philip Hammond, a retired teacher who only has a few months on this board, but many years as a teacher. Re-electing those two would address John's concerns. During my term, I seemed to be the odd man out on several issues, and when I addressed them to the superintendent, he enjoyed telling me I was only one vote. Go back and check it. If you'd like to see that I was the one voting against teacher reductions and eliminating the reading program to save money so we could stay within the money available and not buying new books because the governor didn't give some extra money, which we didn't need to do so. I was the one person on that board that was concerned with the finances. I've had teachers complain about their income versus the superintendent's. There seems to be a lot of talk about divisiveness on the board, and it appears that this is the elephant in the room. That is nothing new. The difference now is there is more than one vote from both sides. From my experience, the voters need to elect Dan Greenwell and Philip Hammond to maintain the experience that John Meyer is talking about and give them the time to work for cohesiveness. Three new members will be good, with four returning. And again, this was written by Paul Gorski, who is from Greenville, South Carolina. Our next letter to the editor is from John Polifka from Mapleton, Iowa, and he writes, out of a sense of paranoia about the consequences of disobeying a draconian law, some school districts have removed from their library shelves such classics as Huxley's Brave New World and Orwell's 1984, not to mention A Thousand Acres, the work of Iowa's most well-known literary daughter, Jane Smiley. Does this sound patently absurd? Well, it should to anyone with some semblance of sensibility. Shame on the Republicans in the Iowa legislature and Governor Kim Reynolds for moving Iowa into the dark ages. It's no wonder that young professionals don't want to stay here. Again, this was written by John Polifka of Mapleton, Iowa. And our last letter to the editor is written by Jake Jungers from Sioux City. I am writing to support the intelligent and forward-thinking decision of Sioux City Community School District Superintendent Dr. Earlywine to recommend the purchase of a 43-acre site to possibly combine the future sites of Sunnyside and Nodland Elementary Schools. I would encourage the future elected members of the school board to support and continue this decision, especially in a world of perpetually endless increases in costs. This very bright move will ensure the future success of the school district, encourage the development of the latest state-of-the-art learning environments for children, and ultimately save and reduce the taxpayers' financial burdens. And again, this was written by Jake Jungers of Sioux City. We'll now move to a column by one of the regulars, and this week it is Cherise Yanni, who is from Sioux City and is the owner and managing partner of Guarantee Roofing, Siding, and Insulation Company. She serves on the Siouxland Initiative Executive Committee, the Orpheum Theater Preservation Board, the Orpheum Theater Endowment Board, and the Iowa Department of Transportation Commission. And today she writes, Siouxland has many nonprofit organizations that have newborns to 18-year-olds as their target market to help teach them lessons for school, how to work together, help keep them healthy, works with them concerning behavior issues, as well as right from wrong. Many of the organizations helping young people are supported by United Way. However, many others have similar goals but do it on their own. For example, Mike McCauley has been calling on me since about 1985 to help support the Native American boys from the reservations that he has playing baseball in the summer. As the years progressed, he and other people that were helping him included kids from other races as well as other tribes. Over the years, they developed some excellent teams and they competed nationally, where they placed third. The teams did not receive money without having to earn it. The late Leonard Gill and his wife Roberta were large supporters of the Native teams and for a time were called Gill Hauling. Leonard and Bert did not just want to hand them money, they wanted them to earn it. Some of their chores were picking up trash, mowing, and shoveling snow. They wanted them to understand the value of the money and having to work for it. In order to make more money, they stood on busy street corners with signs and buckets asking for money for their games outside of Siouxland, including their travel money for tournaments. Due to the players' fundraising, the parents did not have to contribute so that their child could participate in the tournaments. After Gil Holland was no longer the large sponsor, Tony Drake did the same as the Gills. They earned the money. Tony called the team Tony's Res Boys. Eventually, they branched out into other sports such as baseball and softball for girls. Today, money is being raised to support a girls' basketball team at the Siouxland Y. Again, the girls have to do fundraising as well, plus do a little work for the donors to help teach them all about the money and what it takes to earn it. Another organization that I am proud of is the Siouxland Junior Boxing Club in downtown Sioux City. If you travel down Pier Street in the evening around 5:30, you may have seen groups of young people between the ages of 8 and 18 running around the blocks for about 20 minutes. The organization was started in Farley and Dan Farley. Today, Zeke Castro has joined as an assistant coach. In his younger years, he boxed with the Fairbanks and the Farleys. They were junior boxers as well. Felt that boxing helped them when they were young. Their goals are to keep the kids off the streets, teach them respect, good work ethics, learn responsibility, and keeping them off of social media. They have turned the lives around of many of their students. Parents have told them that their children are doing better in school, behaving better, and more serious about doing things the best that they can. The club averages about 30 people a night with a membership of 40. Over the 8 years, the club has had about 550 kids enrolled. Last Wednesday evening, I visited the club to watch them. While there, they did calisthenics after their 20-minute run, worked out on the punching bags, and sparred. It was fun to watch to see which ones took the workout seriously and made me think I would not want to compete against them. The way they went after the bags was amazing to me. If they want to be on the fight team, they have to earn a spot by practicing hard, sparring every night, as well as all of their exercises. One 8-year-old boxer caught my attention. She has such a sweet demeanor. It doesn't look like she would harm a fly. Well, let me tell you, looks are deceiving in this case. I am much taller and bigger than she is. I would not want to mess with her. Watching her hit one of the coaches in the hands was fascinating. She is so fast, hits hard and accurate. One would not want to be without padded gloves or boxing gloves while working with her. The young people are proud of the trophies and fights they have won. If you walk by the windows of their club on 5th and Pierce, you will see the belts and trophies. Thank you to all of our volunteers in Siouxland that are working to help our youth. Thank you for taking time away from your families, and I know you spend your own monies as well. Because of the endless hours of volunteering you are doing, Siouxland and our youth are better for it. And again, this was written by one of the Journal regulars, Charisse Yanni. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, November 5th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now turn to the obituaries. Larry David Frazier, 82, of Omaha, Nebraska, died Friday, October 27th in Omaha. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, November 11th at St. Boniface Catholic Church in Sioux City. Burial prayers will be at Logan Park Cemetery with lunch to follow at the St. Paul Indian Mission Episcopal Church. Larry was born on July 22, 1941, to Nora LaCroix and Erwin Frazier in Winnebago, Nebraska, and spent his formative years in Sioux City. He attended Marty Mission School in Marty, Nebraska, and looked forward to attending their all-school reunion every year. He was a proud member of the Santee Sioux Tribe of Santee, Nebraska. Larry married Wanda Beha Frazier, Omaha, on July 26, 2005. He was extremely proud of his 5 children and their families. Larry was a lifelong chef by trade. He cooked and managed numerous establishments over the years, including Sioux City, Yankton, South Dakota, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Rapid City, South Dakota, Fremont, Nebraska, Oakland, Nebraska, Omaha, and Bellevue, Nebraska. He spent his last few working years running Frazier's Cafe in Tecumseh, Nebraska, before his retirement in 2020. Larry will be remembered as a loving husband, father, grandpa, son, brother, uncle, cousin, and friend. He had a generous spirit and a personality that could light up a room. God blessed him with his gift of cooking, and he found his purpose in the kitchen, serving and feeding thousands of people over the years. He truly had a servant's heart. Larry had a quiet faith that shined best in his passionate love for his friends and family. He loved golfing and played whenever the opportunity presented itself. Most did not know of his love of animals, and in his later years he found so much joy feeding feral cats and squirrels. His grandchildren called him Popo. They loved when he cooked for them, got together at Big Fred's in Omaha, and showed off his gun collection. Louise Wheat Annette King, 71, of Sioux City, passed away Tuesday, October 31st. A memorial visitation will be held on Monday, November 6th from 5 to 7 p.m. with a vigil service at 7 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Burial will be at the Calvary Cemetery at a later date. Louise was born February 13, 1952, to Essa Rodriguez and Catherine Walding. She was a graduate of Bishop Helan High School in Sioux City. Louise entered into holy matrimony on September 10, 1976, to Ronald King at St. Michael's Church in Sioux City. They had three children, Kathy, Christopher, and Timothy. They also had seven grandchildren. She was dearly loved by all her children and grandchildren. Wheat was one of the most supportive individuals anyone could know. She had an unconditional love for all of her children and her grandchildren. If you knew her, you also knew good food. One of everyone's favorites were her tamales. She made many memories with everyone through her cooking and sharing her food. She will be missed by many and continued to be loved. James Donald Jim Chrisman, 71, of Dakota City, Nebraska, passed away Monday, October 30th at his residence. A memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday, November 11th at Salem Lutheran Church with Reverend Sandra Brosh officiating. Visitation with the family will be 1 hour prior at the church. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery at a later date. Arrangements are under the direction of Morin Becker Hunt Funeral Home. Melissa Madeline Earlmeyer Goodman, age 54, passed away peacefully on October 27th with her beloved family at her side in Dallas, Texas. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, November 6th at Faith Family Church of Harlan, Iowa. Reverend Jeff Earlmeyer will officiate. There will be a celebration of Melissa's life in Dallas, Texas at a future date. The Armstrong Van Houten Funeral Home of Mapleton and Danbury are in charge of the funeral arrangements. Bernice Mary Friedel, 76, of Sioux City, passed in Sioux City on Wednesday, November 1st. A funeral mass will be held at 10 a.m. Wednesday, November 8th at Matter Day Parish Immaculate Conception Catholic Church. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, November 7th at Christy Smith Funeral Home's Morningside Chapel. Burial will be at the Memorial Park Cemetery. Bernice was born January 24, 1947 in Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin, to Roman Wendell and Marie Wendell. She graduated from high school in Jefferson, Wisconsin. She married Fred Friedel on April 20, 1968 in Jefferson at St. Lawrence Parish. The couple made their home in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin until they moved to Sioux City in 1985. Bernice managed a women's clothing store and later worked at Yonkers. Bernice was a member of Matter Day Parish. She enjoyed playing cards, flowers, and gardening, and spending time with her family and friends. Nicole Ann Johnson, 41, of Sioux City, passed away on Tuesday, October 31st, at an Omaha, Nebraska hospital. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, November 8th at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Visitation from 5 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday evening at the funeral home. Dorothy Jane Gruis, 93, of North Sioux City, South Dakota, died Saturday, October 28th at her home. Visitation will be held from 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday, November 5th at Christy Smith Funeral Home's Larkin Chapel. The service will be held at 12 p.m. Monday, November 6th at Mayflower Congregational Church. Burial will be at the Memorial Park Cemetery. Judy Virginia Weaver, 79, of Mobile, died Sunday, October 29th at her home. A celebration of life will be from 4 to 6 p.m. November 10th at the Community Center in Mobile. Waterbury Funeral Services of Sioux City is assisting with arrangements. And now our next story, that was the end of the obituaries. Briarcliff announces new major. Briarcliff University on Friday announced the launch of a new major, a Bachelor of Arts degree in Human Performance and Business, offered by the Kinesiology and Human Performance and Business departments. The Human Performance and Business major was approved by the Briarcliff Board of Trustees in their September meeting, according to a press release from Briarcliff. The new major is firmly grounded in principles of ethical practice and social responsibility and provides a broad intellectual liberal arts foundation and skills preparation for long-term career growth and development, Dr. Sherwin Edwin said in a statement. The degree focuses on multidisciplinary and multifunctional skills preparation and professional preparedness in business, entrepreneurship, management, health, fitness, and sports management fields. The major will prepare graduates for various careers such as a coach instructor of health clinics, community wellness or fitness programs, manager or administrator of facilities or programs, and trainer in strength conditioning, according to the press release. Beginning in the spring, with the addition of the Human Performance and Business major, Briarcliff, which reported a total of 941 enrolled students in the fall, will offer 33 undergraduate, 3 graduate, and 3 doctorate degree offerings. St. Luke's names new president of medical staff. Unity Point Health St. Luke's has announced that George McCow, MD, has stepped into the role of president of the medical staff of St. Luke's Regional Medical Center. McCow, an internal medicine doctor, began his tenure on November 1st and will serve a 2-year term, according to a press release from Unity Point. Sandeep Gupta, MD, a pulmonologist, will now serve as immediate past president. The Winnebago Comprehensive Healthcare System's Chief Administration Office, Sharon Frenchman, was awarded the Nebraska Hospital Association's Caring Kind Award on October 27th. For 44 years, the Nebraska Hospital Association has recognized the most caring hospital workers with this award, according to a press release from the Winnebago Comprehensive Healthcare System. Frenchman is an enrolled Winnebago tribal member who has been serving as WCHS as a chief administrative officer since the WCHS was established in July of 2018. Brown family to perform Christmas shows in Lamar's. The Browns, a Lamar's musical group, will kick off their annual holiday concert series this month at their Century Theater in downtown Lamar's. The singing family will perform their Christmas songs over the course of 36 shows from November 10th through December 23rd. A complete schedule of performances and ticket prices are available online at thebrownstheater.com. The performances are at 7 p.m., 1:30 p.m., or 10 a.m., depending on the day. Most of the performances offer a made-from-scratch buffet lunch or dinner, either before the show or after, except for the shows on November 24th and 25th. Earlier this year, the Browns, Shelley, Michaela, Adam, and Andrew, teamed up with Club 44 Records and went to the Czech Republic to join the Prague Philharmonic Orchestra to record a Christmas song collection, according to a press release. The holiday songs include classics like It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year, Silver Bells, O Holy Night, Good King Wenceslas, and Little Drummer Boy. Their Christmas spectacular in Lamar's will feature brand new music the family performed with the Prague Philharmonic Orchestra, according to the press release. In 2015, the Browns purchased a former bank building at the corner of Plymouth Street and Central Avenue in downtown Lamar's with the vision of creating a performing arts space. The historic building, which for many years housed a bank and later a law office, became the Browns Central Theater. This is the 9th year the Browns have hosted performances and special events at the venue. Our next story is Stacking the Deck, Lifelong Learning. Bridge Class is about staying mentally active while making friends. Carol Rogers began playing bridge when she was still an undergraduate student at the University of Iowa. The game was fun, but also challenging, Rogers, a retired elementary school teacher, said. No matter how often you played bridge, it made you think on your feet. Sure enough, Rogers is still playing the card game after more than 50 years. Indeed, she even teaches beginning bridge as a Western Iowa Tech Community College Institute for Lifelong Learning course. According to Lifelong Learning Coordinator Sue Owens, the bridge class is one of the program's most popular offerings. Sue said, playing card games can keep people sharp as we age. Not only does bridge help us play with problem-solving skills, it allows us to engage with other people. And there is plenty of evidence to back that up. A University of California, Berkeley, has found strong evidence that an area in the brain used in playing bridge can stimulate the immune system. That is because players must use memory, visualization, and sequencing techniques. There are an estimated 25 million bridge players in the United States, including such well-known aficionados as Warren Buffett and Bill Gates. Jane Patnaud enjoys the intricacies of the card game, even though the Elk Point, South Dakota woman has to constantly refer back to her dog-eared cheat sheet that Rogers gave her more than 3 years ago. Like Rogers, Patnaud is a retired educator. She said with a smile, I should really ask Carol for new instructions, but this sheet is still legible. During the beginning bridge session held on November 1st, Patnaud played the game with three of her former college classmates. This must be the Mount Marty College table, Benji Schmitz, who was Patnaud's bridge partner, said. We all went there. Surprisingly, the Mount Marty table was made up of regular players, even though the class was geared towards bridge beginner. That's the funny part of Carol's class, Owen said. Participants will start as beginners and have so much fun that they'll start their own bridge clubs together. As soon as the class is offered again, they'll re-enroll. Which is true of Maury Rao, who regularly plays bridge with her friend Susan Stewart in a bridge club as well as at lifelong learning classes. Bridge is something you can play often and still have fun challenging yourself, Rao said. Maury and Susan are both retired attorneys, Camille Ludow, another bridge player, noted. If they make a controversial play, they'll just argue their case. During the course of each of her two-hour beginning bridge classes, Rogers moves from table to table, offering both advice and as well as strategic tips. While that day's class was made up of former teachers, lawyers, and nurses, she said bridge players can come from all walks of life. Bridge can be pretty mentally stimulating game, she said. More importantly, it is a social game. Participants may start my bridge class as strangers, but they'll leave as friends. Now, a little bit more information about the lifelong learning. It's the Institute for Lifelong Learning programs are available in many subject areas, such as games, history, wellness, technology, travel, and many more. The majority of the classes are held at the Western Iowa Tech Community College at various days and times. And if you want more information, you can contact the Lifelong Learning Coordinator, Sue Owens, at 712-317-3442. We'll move back into the upcoming election and have a story on council. School board candidates receive endorsements. Marguerite Cortez, Earl Miller, Semahar Gebrektian, and Lance Emke have received endorsements from the Sioux City Education Association, Western Iowa Labor Federation, and the Siouxland Chamber of Commerce for seats on the Sioux City School Board. For Sioux City Council, Tom Murphy received endorsements from the Chamber of Commerce and the Western Iowa Labor Federation. Trey Lalee also received endorsements from the SCEA and the Western Iowa Labor Federation. John Myers received an endorsement from the Chamber of Commerce. A total of 11 candidates are vying for 5 open seats on the 7-member Sioux City School Board. The seats are currently held by Dan Greenwell, Taylor Goodvin, Monique Scarlett, Bernie Scolaro, and Philip Hammond. The ballot had two term length options for candidates. Candidates could either run for one of the 4 available 4-year terms or the 1 available 2-year term. Greenwell and Gebrekian are running for the two-year term, while Lee, Miller, Tricia Rivers, Dustin Rhodes, Philip Hammond, Myers, Cortez, Lemke, and Jebediah Hibbs are running for the four-year terms. The Sioux City Education Association represents roughly 1,000 teachers in the Sioux City schools. In early October, the union held a candidate forum asking all 11 candidates about their goals and beliefs. According to a news release, Lee, Cortez, Miller, Emke, and Gebrekian received endorsements from the group. The Western Iowa Labor Federation, a coalition of 500 state and local AFL-CIO labor councils, endorsed the same candidates as the teacher union for the school board. Jen Pellet, the federation's president, said they took input from the teachers and other staff in the district for who they wanted on the board. Tom Murphy has been endorsed by the Western Iowa Labor Federation for Sioux City Council. The Siouxland Chamber of Commerce Good Government Committee also held candidate interviews, according to a news release. Cortez, Emke, Gebrekian, Myers, and Miller received the endorsement for the school board. Murphy received the endorsement for the city council. Bird flu detected in Clay County. Highly pathogenic avian influenza, also known as bird flu, has been confirmed at three Clay County farms, the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship announced Friday in a statement. The three affected sites are game bird duck farms, with one of the farms also containing a small backyard mixed species flock. The department also listed a site in Hamilton County as being affected by the bird flu on Friday. The Hamilton County flock consists of commercial breeding chickens. Commercial and backyard flock owners should prevent contact between their birds and wild birds, the statement said. Sick birds or unusual deaths among birds should be immediately reported to state or federal officials. If producers suspect signs of HPAI in their flocks, they should contact their veterinarian immediately. Possible cases must also be reported to the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardships at 515-281-5305. According to the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the recent HPAI detections in birds do not represent a public health concern. It remains safe to eat poultry products, according to the statement, which noted that consumers should always utilize the proper handling and cooking of eggs and poultry products, including cooking to an internal temperature of 165 degrees. HPAI is a highly contagious viral disease affecting bird populations. HPAI can travel in wild birds without those birds appearing sick, but is often fatal to domestic bird populations, including chickens and turkeys. The virus can spread through the droppings or the nasal discharge of an infected bird, both of which can contaminate dust and soil. We'll now go to Dear Abby, our first letter. I've been with my husband, Harry, for 10 years, married for 4, and already I'd like a divorce. We have 2 small children. I'm a stay-at-home mom while he works and pays the bills. The problem is, he feels that because he works, he doesn't have anything else to do. No, he doesn't have to do anything else. He doesn't help around the house, help with the kids, spend time with us, nothing. I only ask that he do these things on his days off, but his days off are reserved strictly for himself. Some days I could use a hand with our children. While I'm absolutely doing everything, he just sits acting like he doesn't hear or see what's going on in front of him. Even after seeing me become overwhelmed and frustrated, he won't help me. I've had 1,000 conversations with him about stepping up more than when he's at home, but it goes in one ear and out the other. I'd rather be single than have him just sit around when he's home because he pays for everything. Am I wrong to feel this way? I need help. And signed, Out of Balance in North Carolina. And the reply, offer your husband a choice. Either the two of you talk with a marriage and family therapist to help rid him of his selective deafness, or you hire someone to help with the heavier chores he's unwilling to do. If he balks, remind him that you know he's tired of your nagging and it would be cheaper than a divorce. Dear Abby, I have been with my wife for 23 years, married 19 of them. We have 2 grown children, ages 22 and 20. She recently realized she's still in love with the guy she dated just before me. How did I find out? Well, one day my wife and I were watching a TV show together, and out of nowhere she asked me my opinion on open marriages. I gave her a vague answer and started investigating why she asked me that question. That's when I discovered text messages, phone calls, and her diary for the last 9 months. As far as I can tell, they haven't had sex yet, but she wants to. I did not confront her about it. I felt bad for invading her privacy, but then again, she was being sneaky. I need to know if I should stay or go. Signed, Uncovered in Pennsylvania. And the response. Copy those texts and her diary, then have a talk with your wife and ask her why she asked about your feelings on open marriage, because it was out of character. After she answers, say you have been thinking strongly about her question and strongly feel your marriage should be monogamous. Then tell her you've seen the calls, texts, and diary, and if she wants to have sex with her old boyfriend, you will file for divorce. And that completes the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, November 5th. I'm Dagna, your reader. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.